Welcome to Crown and Crozier, the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship. I'm your host, Patrick Brown. On April 16th, 2019, crowds in Paris gathered to pray and to sing as they watched fire engulf the roof of Notre Dame Cathedral. The fire was eventually extinguished, but it wasn't long before flames were once again being fanned. Controversy has been ignited around the plans for rebuilding the interior of the church, with some critics arguing that the proposals are tantamount to the Disneyfication of the 900-year-old monument to Our Lady. In this episode, we dive deeper into the debate, which is made all the more complex by the fact that the cathedral isn't actually owned by the local archdiocese. Like tens of thousands of churches in Europe, it's owned by the state. Our guest for this episode is one of the most well-known expatriate art historians in Europe, Dr. Elizabeth Lev. Dr. Lev has lived and worked as a tour guide in Rome for over 20 years and teaches at Duquesne University's Italian campus as well as the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas. She's the author of multiple books, the most recent of which traces the history of St. Joseph's depiction in art. Before we begin, don't forget to subscribe to the show, follow us on social media, or leave us a rating on Apple or Spotify.
There are two swords. And the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, at God's first.
Dr. Elizabeth Lev, welcome to Crown and Crozier.
Thank you very much for having me.
It was April 15th, 2019, when the world watched in horror as Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris was engulfed in flames. And in the ensuing weeks and months, as the pieces were being picked up, there was something else that was ignited, and that was some controversy as the plans started to coalesce around rebuilding. So we're here today to pick your brain on the conversation, the debates around the rebuilding proposals, and also digging into some of the broad implications of what it means to restore a treasured church. So perhaps to kick us off, maybe you can just tell us when you first heard, or perhaps when you first saw the footage of the church in flames, how did you react?
Well, I was actually called while it was burning by a friend of mine who works at MSNBC. So I spent most of the time of the coverage of the really most dramatic part of the fire. I was on live with MSNBC, and it was a very interesting situation to be on one hand trying to explain what was in the church, about the church, answering questions, talking about how these things happened. So from an objective standpoint, at the same time as, you know, an art historian, a person who's been in that church a million times, a person who's done tours of that church, a person who loves that church. And then it got the better of me when the flesh fell in, and just this sort of gasp on air that I'm afraid I lost the objective professor voice and really just became yet another heartbroken viewer of what was truly a devastating event. All the more amazing that it takes place in 2019, where we might be foolish enough to think that we are too sophisticated for this kind of disaster to happen.
What are some of your fondest memories of the church?
I've gone to visit the day, the one of the days when they put the crown of thorns on display. So I have a very fond memory of getting in the very long line. I just remember being happy to be in this very long line of people who were going up to venerate the crown of thorns. And then on the way out, running into all these people I knew from all over the place, really just a beautiful example of what an ecclesia is, which is bringing people together. I have a memory of seeing it for the first time when I was really something of a little girl. I had already studied a little bit of art. And of course, when you first start studying art, the great cathedrals are a part of your repertoire. And to just walk in and see the stained glass for the very first time, to see these soaring halls, everything that you'd read about, it wasn't made up, it was true. So these are a few of the thoughts and memories I have of it.
You've seen and studied a lot of the churches in Europe, Holy Land, I imagine other parts of the world. How is Notre Dame set apart from some of the other crown jewels in the church's repertoire?
Well, Notre Dame is a particularly important church because it is one of the great early Gothic cathedrals. It's one of the charter members of this new style that begins in the 12th century that allows it's an expression of human ingenuity and human creativity and human desire to achieve in the creation of this space that on one hand, it is a very human structure. On the other hand, it is a powerfully transcendent structure. I think one of the things about this Gothic era that is so compelling for people is that on one hand, we are aware of the stonemasons and the guilds and the people who built it, but the effect these people created is something that brings us out of this world. And I think Notre Dame stands as one of the great examples of that, together with Chartres and perhaps Reims and a few of the other cathedrals. But really, Notre Dame is one of the charter members of this great new style.
And pardon my ignorance, but juxtaposed against some of the other great cathedrals in Europe, is Notre Dame the oldest? And was it unique in terms of just how long it took to build?
It took a very long time to build. So a cathedral like Chartres, which is very close in age, one of the things about Chartres was all built in kind of one program, whereas Notre Dame was built basically from 1160 to 13 something. It took a much longer time to complete the constructions of Notre Dame. But it's not the first Gothic structure, but it is sort of it's in Paris. And it's also a cathedral that is desired by the king. I mean, a big part of the construction of Notre Dame is that this is going to be a project in which the king is centralizing the faith of France in Paris, in this area of Paris. And so it's like a heart and core. If already Île-de-France is in the center of France, then to have the church in this island in the center of that, it really was intended to be like the beating heart at the core of the country.
So with all that context in mind, and you touched upon this a little bit in the column that you wrote for the Washington Post in late 2021, which got a lot of attention, among other reasons, it was a bit of a counterbalance between some of the other cris de cœur, if you will, some of the other concerns being expressed around the nature of the proposals. But in your article, you mentioned that, you know, one thing we had to bear in mind, Notre Dame hasn't always gotten the love or gotten the TLC it deserves. It's gone through periods of neglect. Just speak to that a little bit more.
No, absolutely. It is a church that was, it's gone through worse than neglect. It's lived through what we would describe as flat out vandalism. The French Revolution, even before that, in the Renaissance era, they widened the doors, they damaged some of the facade because they wanted to be able to do different things within the church. The French Revolution, of course, really did the bulk of the damage, beheading the statues in the exterior. All the statues of the kings in the exterior were beheaded, and then gutting the interior in order to turn it into a temple of reason. Then after the restoration of the monarchy was interested in being restored, not so interested in Notre Dame, to the point where Victor Hugo wrote The Hunchback of Notre Dame to create a worldwide appeal. So basically what the fire did in 2019 was to focus all of this attention on you've got to restore this cathedral and people pouring money in. That was exactly what Victor Hugo was doing, except hoping that we wouldn't have to get to the point where there was a fire in order to get people to think about restoring, or most importantly, he was trying to galvanize the government into restoring the building, which desperately needed Restoration. And after that, indeed, it was Viollet-le-Duc, who was the sort of famous restorer of Gothic cathedrals, intervened very heavily in the church. And as a matter of fact, that flesh, that spire that so dramatically fell in, was a 19th century spire, certainly not the original spire of the church from its construction. So yes, it's had many, many years of neglect. And as a matter of fact, there was a lot of discussion coming into 2019 that the church really needed another revamp, or even walking through the church in the 2000s before the fire, it was always a little grimy. It really did need a little bit. It did need a little bit more TLC, as you say. And apparently, as they were starting the work in the roof, is when the fire broke out.
My understanding was, in the early part of the 20th century, there was a seminal moment of sorts where the ownership or the responsibility for the cathedral actually swapped hands from the archdiocese to the state, or perhaps an organ or an arm of the state. Can you speak to that a little bit more and some of the genesis there?
That's where the biggest problem lies. The understanding of how this cathedral is supposed to be maintained, the understanding of who's supposed to do what. As a matter of fact, when you asked me about this podcast, I sort of went looking online to see what the state of things were, and you sort of reading some of the comments that people make about it. It's just, there's a magnificent amount of ignorance about how this church is run. The churches were handed over to the state. So first of all, in the French Revolution, the church lost everything.
Right.
All of the church buildings, they were all taken away from the church. And then some of them were restored to the church. In 1905, on the 9th of December, the French state passed a law which was really intended to officially separate church and state. And so only church buildings that were consecrated after 1905 could be privately owned. Every church pre-1905 belongs to the state, which means that the state would be responsible for their upkeep. The clergy in the church is allowed or permitted to offer services to the faithful in these churches, but the churches are really fundamentally the property of the state, to the point where the French state owns 32,000 churches, 6,000 chapels, and 87 cathedrals. So there it is. And so Notre Dame is the responsibility of the French state.
I'll just confess, that whole arrangement sounds completely bizarre to me. What was the rationale and the impetus for that law in 1905?
We have a very similar situation in Italy, by the way.
Most of the
churches, yes, it's a much more checkerboarded situation. Like, there's some churches that belong to the Vatican, but not very many. There are some that belong to the state. There are some that are still privately owned. It's not as neat as the French law. In 1905, France was really... Remember that when you look at the period of the Revolution, really ousted religion, and there was a very active and very passionate party that really wanted religion out of the public square. With the return of the kings after the fall of Napoleon, there was the return of religion, but this tension went back and forth through the several other, there were several other revolutions or insurgencies that happened during the course of the 19th century. Entering into the 20th century, France decided that it would just settle the question once and for all. It is a lay state, is a city of laïcité. And so the churches would be owned by the state because they're part of communal property of the state. It's hard to understand, but it is very common in Europe.
Is it your sense that there's just kind of a general acceptance or tolerance on the part of this arrangement, on the part of the faithful and the National Bishops' Conference in the different European countries? Is it just, this is kind of the best arrangement we're going to get, and we're going to make the best of it? Is that the philosophy?
Yes, for the moment, yes, without a doubt. In the case of France, there really is such a tiny number of practicing faithful that to demand the return of the churches would be, I suspect, ludicrous. It's a vicious circle if you had more churches that were actually churches. But the fact is that I think it is a reflection of, or it was perhaps a very successful part of the lay state to eventually be able to sort of bring in a considerably more lay population. France is a very, very small church-going population, very, very few professed Catholics. So it's not something that looks like it would change anytime soon. In Italy, it's a different situation, but no, there there's not much chance that there's going to be, first of all, nobody wants to have to pay for them.
I think we could do a whole separate podcast or a whole separate series on that issue.
That's an issue which I actually have very strong feelings about, but it's a separate story.
For purposes of this conversation here, I mean, why don't we pivot? The fire happens in 2019, time is spent picking up the pieces and then putting pen to paper on plans for a restoration. What are the general plans for restoration in a way that a lay person would understand? Like, what are kind of the major features of the rebuilding program?
So the rebuilding program requires the reconstruction of the roof. So there are two different things involved here. So the interior decoration and what's going to happen as far as the design of the interior church is one thing. The actual project, which is underway right now, which is supposed to be done by 2024, we'll see, is a reconstruction project. The reconstruction project has been extremely complicated because, to begin with, the fire happened around scaffolding. So the scaffolding melted into some of the wood of the fire, and just the job of extricating the metal scaffolding from the mess, all the while trying to make sure the rest of the roof doesn't cave in, has been the first incredibly complicated task, and that they are completing. Then there's the question of sourcing the wood, because they're going to have to reconstruct the timber, the so-called forest, which are the planks of wood that are the roof of the building is made of. Then after that, there will be the recovering, revaulting, probably. The roof was originally, so the wood is actually what's holding up the ceiling, but then the interior of from the interior, it's vaulting, so they've got to put the vaults back in, the webbing, as they call it. And then ultimately the return of the spire and the exterior roofing. Once that is done, they can start worrying about the internal decoration.
And my understanding is, with respect to the interior plans of this restoration, they involve certain things. Well, I've read here and there that they involve modifying some of the side chapels, perhaps making more space for visitors or pilgrims to walk around, and that might involve either relocating or reducing some of the confessionals that were on the margins of the peripheries of the cathedral. Am I correct in that understanding?
Well, yes, you are. I'm kind of amused at the idea. I'm very amused at the idea that someone's like scandalized that the confessionals are going to somehow be reduced. Because, you know, the one thing I really noticed is that people were always standing in line for confession at Notre Dame, right? So that was like, that was definitely what everybody in there is for. So, I'm going to throw in another point here that I think just to kind of, as we close out the structural and we start talking about the actual decoration, I do think it is a little bit important to understand that those of your listeners who were watching that famous fire, you may remember that people were pouring in with donations almost immediately. And so that this money came pouring in, you know, Pinault and Arnault, the big French businessmen, you know, I'll give $100 million. And then the Friends of Notre Dame, which is a organization that had been founded to actually try to get some restoration work done, was what the people were pouring in money through that. So basically, eventually what happened is that $967 million it's almost $1 billion they have for this restoration. And just, I wanted to return to the fact that we were talking about this kind of funny laws. It's interesting to discover that almost immediately, as soon as that money came in, within the year, the French government passed a law saying that money could only be used for the actual reconstruction of the building. And for the internal decoration, it's going to require extra fundraising. So you have the poor bishop of Paris kind of running around with a cup saying, you know, could you help us redecorate the interior? And people are looking at them saying, but you've got $1 billion. But the $1 billion, none of it is at the disposal of the church that is trying to, the church is in charge of arranging how the interior is going to work. So it's just, I just wanted to kind of throw that in there because I think it's a kind of an interesting point that 1905 law seems to have had a new codicil where that the French government was able to grab the $1 billion and, you know, use that for the church. There's a lot of complaint that there's not a lot of transparency as to where that money is going, and that the church, for this decoration plan that we're talking about, not 1 cent of that money that was collected is going to go for that. So they're going to have to come up with maybe 6 or 7 million more for the interior, which, you know. And so to get to your actual question, the plan, there was a plan that was conditionally approved. I think it was last December, I think it was conditionally approved. And it was put together by Father Gilles Drouin, who is kind of their, he was the sort of the guru of the organization of the decoration. And it did involve clearing out the space. But what he means by clearing out the space is one of the most frustrating things about visiting Notre Dame before the fire is that they had all these rickety, ugly wicker chairs that occupied the entire center of the church. And so you had to kind of wend your way around. Basically, you were forced into the exterior. You looked down the middle, and there was just this sea of chairs and all this stuff roped off. And it was an annoying aspect of the visit, and it was very ugly. And for those who don't know, chairs, pews, they are not originally part of these churches. Notre Dame was not designed to have church and chairs. It was not designed to have pews. Pews are a Protestant invention. So it would have been a big open space. When people first walked in, unfortunately, a lot of times people rode their horses in there, but that's a whole other story. But it would be a big open space. And the architecture is supposed to speak to you. That vastness, those soaring columns that open up to these huge walls of light, that was the point. And so to begin with, when he's talking about opening this up, I'm like, well, I don't have a problem with this. This is a great idea. Give the people space to move around so it feels like a church that is gathering us together instead of shoving us off into the little side area. So that was the first part of the plan. One of the things that article in the Washington Post that got cut out of my article in the Washington Post was that Father Drouin was very interested. It's a very catechetical design that he has in mind. And he wanted to create an axis where you came in the main central portal. His idea, I think, at the time was to put the baptismal font almost immediately in that sort of early, almost like a narthex area. And then looking down behind it would be the altar and that immense cross, the cross that we saw. Remember, the light was shining on it the next day when they looked into the cathedral, which has at the bottom the King's Louis the 15th, and this was the King's offering up their crown to Notre Dame. And so that was the axis. That's the principal axis that he wanted to create. Now, I'm not really running into problems with these. It seems to me that this is a plan to make people remember, okay, so this is, we have this initiation into the faith through baptism, and then we move towards the altar where we have the Eucharist. These are the two stars of our sacraments, right? Yeah. That was the principal axis he has in mind. Then there was the question of the side chapels. And the side chapels seem to be where the conflicting opinions come from. My first question to people who complain about the side chapels is, does anybody remember anything in any of the side chapels at all? I would
love to weigh in. I've never had the opportunity to visit the church, but
little corridor with a bunch of statues of Mary and the left transept. There are chapels that are really closed off. Nobody ever goes into them. You just pass by them. There's a little kind of, sort of towards the back, you have a couple monuments to some of the former archbishops of Paris. And then you get to the back and they have a little wooden model of how you made the cathedral. And I'm not so sure what people are feeling a nostalgia for.
I wonder if this kind of goes back to the earlier theme of another form of neglect that the church experienced over the centuries.
Absolutely.
These side chapels seem to have been neglected in terms of
struck me as it was again, as someone who really did tours of that church with some regularity, it was very hard to construct a story around those chapels. And usually, like in most places that I go to, there's a way you can see the history, at least in Rome. Maybe it's a luxury of Rome and Florence and these churches, but there's a way you can see the history unfolding even in different eras of decoration within the church. So it's the church's story is visible. It was really hard in Notre Dame because so many things have been removed, so many things have been destroyed, and really a lot of those those chapels, they just looked like repositories. Like, we don't know where to put these extra chairs. We'll just stick them in that chapel. The chapels certainly weren't alive. There's certainly this, except for, you know, the one chapel, which is the Adoration Chapel. They were not, there was no sense of these chapels being used. And a little section was roped off for prayer in front of the Notre Dame de Paris statue. But it's just, it's not, it didn't have a coherency. It didn't have any logic. And it just, half the time, it looked like you were looking into broom closets. So again, Father Dumas wants to take an opportunity to give some rhyme and reason to these. I'd give the man a chance.
So from what I understand, his plans for giving rhyme or reason to the chapels, they do involve some form or some measure of, I want to use my words carefully here, but some kind of use of digital technology or digital display or the digital projection of passages from scripture, perhaps some graphics or images or art onto the walls of these refurbished, modified chapels as part of a catechetical experience or a catechetical journey. Is that correct? Is that the
plan? Yes, he's very interested in using modern technology to, okay. He's interested in using modern technology. So the chapels is in the plan that he proposed, whether or not this is actually going to happen is a question, but in the plan that he proposed, he, was creating chapels that start with an Old Testament series. I think you came and you went to the left and you would have like a Genesis chapel. You move your way through the stories, through the prophets, until you eventually get to the area around the Passion. There's a whole decoration around the choir. There's an actual physical separation around the altar called, which is a choir, which is decorated with these wooden carvings of the stories of the life of Christ. And then on the way out, there are stories of apostles and saints. But here's the thing. In the midst of that, he wanted to add chapels that involved the five continents. He wanted a chapel that would allude to Laudato Si. And so the five continents are part of the recognition that Notre Dame is visited by more tourists than faithful. The tourists come from all over the world, countries that don't have exposure, very little exposure to Christianity. So I think what he wanted to do was to use new technology, which gets a lot of people's attention. So every day I come up through the Vatican Museums and we come up this long escalator and there's a huge jumbotron on the left, which just has kind of images of Francis, Pope Francis doing various things. So it's just like it's a melange or a slideshow almost thing of Francis, all Francis's activities. And every day I see people standing in front of it transfixed. Now I, who am going to the Vatican Museums for Michelangelo and Raphael, I'm like, I barely notice it. It's out the corner of my eye. I'm like, but let's get to this. But then I see the people who are entering into the museums. They aren't being guided. They're just, you know, here we are in this museum. And the very first thing they see and the first thing they're attracted by is this lovely images of the Pope celebrating Mass or the Pope doing that prayer service in the pandemic, the Pope picking up children, the Pope in some faraway corner of the world. And they love it. So, I mean, why... Again, I think maybe giving this a chance, giving it, if it stinks, I can promise you no one's going to pay any attention to it. It's going to break and it'll be sitting there until the next time it's time to revamp Notre Dame in another 200 years. But in the meantime, an attempt to communicate with people, even through the system that might seem too modern for the gargoyles of Notre Dame, but you know those gargoyles and those vaults were very modern in their day. So the more we move on in this the more that this moves forward, the more I keep thinking I have less and less of an objection. I'm sure there are chapels that I'm not going to like. I'm sure there's going to be some art that I'm going to be like, ugh, why. But on the other hand, I think the idea of creating an itinerary, a didactic itinerary to understand the history of Christianity in that space, in a world where even Christians don't know their own story, it's worth a shot. Let's see what happens.
I'm going to play my cards and say, as I've read about more details of the plans and the restoration and this specific aspect of it, the plans to have some kind of digital display or projection, I'll confess my skeptical antenna were activated. you know, a couple of themes and considerations come to mind, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. One, I mean, this is a question I've come across in some commentary. A few critics have said, well, can we possibly fathom something similar being installed in other glorious places of worship in London, Westminster Abbey, or in Rome at St. Peter's, or in Jerusalem, Church of the Nativity, Church of the Holy Sepulchre? How would you respond to that?
It's a case-by-case scenario. I mean, you handed me on a platter with St. Peter's, where the organization of St. Peter's, which was never gutted and emptied and then sort of thrown back in there the way that Notre Dame was. I mean, St. Peter's is the organization of St. Peter's chapels was very carefully thought out. And even through the years, as we've made, you know, little changes here and there, you could think about putting digital technology in there, but it would be completely moot next to things like the Pietà, next to an itinerary that kind of leads you up to Bernini. It would just, creating a little room where you sat and looked at a TV doesn't really make sense in a space like that, since it has such a powerful and much more coherent voice. Other churches that might have this kind of lacuna, Notre Dame has a real lacuna. It has a real lack. There is a certain inability, besides the beautiful stained glass is very beautiful, there's an inability to really grasp and recount not the history of Christianity in France, not the faith of the people, not even like an understanding of Mary really in there. It's kind of, these are sort of random things put together. The church once had a series of decorations which were called the Maze. They were 76 paintings that were generally taken from the Acts of the Apostles, but those were taken out and most of them were brought to the Louvre. And this proposal actually suggests bringing back some of those paintings. So these 17th century paintings, you put them by, you know, there's one chapel with a 17th century painting, there's one chapel with digital technology. It's not the worst thing. You know, there's a really interesting digital technology we've been using here in Italy for sites that are not, well, we use it for one site that is now secular, but it used to be a chapel. It's called a church. It's called Santa Maria Antiqua, and it's nestled under the Palatine Hill. It was a church that was basically built somewhere around, started in the 500s. It was destroyed in 847 by an earthquake. They rediscovered it, and they found the remains of painting. And through digital technology, they project on the walls what the paintings used to look like, with these little kind of sayings of, you know, this is where they venerated Cosmas and Damien and the medical saints. And you know, something like that where you walked in and they kind of gave you a recreation of what a chapel might have looked like in the Middle Ages, or a history of the history of the church in one of the five continents. Again, there's room for creativity here. I don't think we need to be afraid of the art forms of the new technology. Oil painting was new once. Stained glass was new once. It was all new once. And now we think of it as the most venerable thing. And so even though it does require, you know, you plug it in, which with our energy crisis here in Europe, who knows? But the fact is, I think it's not, oh my gosh, Notre Dame today and tomorrow they're going to be invading St. Peter's. Although they do flash those, they just, you know what they just did in St. Peter's? They're doing it right now. It's actually up until the 16th. Every night they're flashing the history of St. Peter on the facade. They're using a projection of the life of St. Peter flashed onto the facade of St. Peter's Basilica. So we are using that kind of technology here.
Yeah, no, I take your point that at some stage, new techniques and new technology are exactly that. They're all new, and there can be a reflexive resistance and a concern around new techniques and new technology and new means perhaps corrupting or perverting or detracting from tried, tested, and true. A separate but a related theme, I wonder is, and I'll admit I perhaps have a tendency to gravitate towards this myself, but as it relates to the use of digital means for prayer and worship, is digital media well suited to the transmission of transcendent truth? In architecture and in church, in churches and cathedrals across Europe and the Holy Land, for example, one might walk away with this sense that the medium through which durable and permanent truth is being transmitted is itself durable, perhaps permanent. That maybe it might be too strong a word, but do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, I do.
We have brick and mortar structures. We have physical, tangible realities that reflect and convey the reality of the truth that's being transmitted. And some might argue that digital means are just not equipped to do that.
So I think one of the first things, maybe it's a holdover from what we were saying before, but it's an introduction into what we're talking about now. I think there is a concern, and it is a very real concern, that with digital media, sometimes it is new for new's sake. So Sometimes people like the new just because it's new, because this is, it's new, so we have to do it because it's new, and never mind that it has any pertinence to it. So I think I'd like to draw a distinction in what I'm saying, is that I don't believe in news for new's sake. Just because it's a new medium, we have to use it. It's so clever. But right. I do think new applied to creativity, a formed creativity, a bent towards trying to communicate the eternal truths through this new medium, it is something that is worth giving it a shot. Insofar as where you really resonate, and where I truly cannot throw up an argument, is that you are right. It is, and these are eternal truths. And the idea of the brick and mortar structures, which in the history of Rome, I mean, here I am in Rome. And in Rome, our Church of St. John Lateran, it's on the universal calendar because it was the first time we got to put bricks down, one brick on top of the other, and come together to be, we're drawn together in this place. And the way these places, these churches were designed to really bring us to Christ. They were symbolic of Christ. And the physical experience inside these churches, whether it's St. John Lateran or the magnificent cathedrals or the little bitty San Carlino, that brick and mortar presence of being drawn together is something that is a fundamental, I believe, fundamental part of our faith. And so that we try to substitute, as we try to substitute with this ephemeral media, something that we think might be forever because it's in the cloud, but indeed that cloud is exactly that. It is something that could perfectly well be gone tomorrow. So, and I think one of the ways we can really understand the weaknesses and the limitations of that is when the church tried during the pandemic to switch people to the digital form of worship, a digital form of worship that was very easily mistaken as something that could substitute the actual physical presence in the real presence of Christ in the church, in the Eucharist, in the liturgy. And there I think we saw absolutely the weakness and the inability to understand that just trying to throw out the digital media as, or to offer digital media as a substitute, or as this is just as good, or we'll just do this now. No, it can be a complement, but it is very evident that you cannot digitally receive Christ. Therefore, you have to be someplace to receive Christ. And that place needs to be a structure which can bring people together. So you hit the most sensitive part of the story right there. But again, I'm not saying Notre Dame is now, obviously, it's a building that they're about to rebuild. It's a structure that's been there for 800 years. The brick and mortar is there. The history is there. What is missing is the understanding. And so maybe this media can help a world that is attuned, that understands this way. Let me give you another example. When the Christians first started making art, right, they used as a basis of their art. So we're talking about the 3rd century AD. When the Christians first decide to make art, what do they use as a basis? They use Roman designs. They use Roman images. The guy with the sheep over his shoulder is Hermes Psychopompos. The Orons is Pietas. They're using images that the Romans are going to understand. The repertoire is a visual language that the Romans are receptive to. Right now, in our post-Christian world, the visual language that many people are receptive to understand something right now, is digital. They like to watch screens. So if we can find a way to talk to them through those screens, instead of all the other people who manage to talk to people through screens, giving them the worst ideas in the world, again, we're the ones holding the truth here. We should be able to come up with a creative way to use this medium that people believe it when it's on a screen. So it does come, there is a certain point where we may not think the media is ideal for everything, But I think we have to come to terms with the fact that this is the way that many people understand, accept, receive information, and believe.
That's all beautifully and eloquently said, and it's a good companion to the last observation, which I was going to make. Notwithstanding kind of my initial skepticism, and I'll be honest, I think that it's still somewhat enduring around where this all may go and for the side chapels in Notre Dame. It did get me thinking of the many churches I've been to, even my own home parish here in Ottawa, where people follow along the mass on their cell phones. Or it's not uncommon to see a priest come to the pulpit and recite his homily from an iPad. Mm-hmm. And there are many parishes that put the words for the opening, for the processional and the recessional hymns up on a screen for people to follow along with. I'll be honest, I'm personally not the biggest fans of those means, but it struck me that, you know, amidst all these concerns and criticisms around Notre Dame being Disneyfied, or the Disneyfication of Notre Dame through these digital projections, it occurred to me, well, you know, in many parishes all over the world, we're kind of there. So I think your observations are certainly valid in that light as well.
Well, I think the way I would put it is this. Insofar as the Disneyfication is concerned, Disney is very effective at communicating to a very, very high number of people. They are people, everybody knows who Bambi is, everybody. They have been very, very successful in communicating their stories. Most people know the Disney version of a story more than the actual literary version of the story. So picking up a little something from that is not bad. The idea that you have a group of people walking into a church that are somehow well-versed in their gospel stories, that understand the ins and outs of the liturgy, that understand sacraments, that is not what you've got here. You've got people who are walking through the church looking for a Disney. If you can teach them and entertain them at the same time, so much the better. And thirdly, the idea that Disney puts itself out as the happiest place on earth, I think it's time for us to give them a run for the money, because we all know the happiest place on earth is not on earth, on top of that, but it's certainly not going to be Disney. The place where we get a glimpse of the happiest place for all humanity is indeed inside the church.
There's an element of the children of light being as shrewd as the children of darkness and taking a page from the Disney playbook. Just for our last question here, one thing that does gnaw at me, I mean, I got to be honest, just the fact that the restoration for this crown jewel in some ways rests in the hands of the secular state. It gives me pause. It gives me concern. It gives me skepticism. And more recently, when I look at President Macron talking about we're going to get the restoration in time, we're going to have it ready in time for the 2024 Olympics, I think, yeah, I see where you're coming from on one hand. But on the other hand, you know, this thing took centuries. It took decades and centuries to build. Let's leave the timeline in God's hands and take the time that's needed to get it done in a way that does justice to this church and not for some arbitrary sporting event. In terms of looking ahead, what are your hopes and expectations, and how are those shaped and tempered by your own skepticism and hope for what this project can yield?
Well, where do I begin? A part of Notre Dame was actually, in the beginning, a bit of a vanity project on the part of Louis VII. He wanted to centralize the power of France. And so I can see that Macron is following in the fine tradition of the kings of France of turning it into a vanity project so that he can be there to cut the ribbon. At the end of the day, that's what this is about. He wants to cut the ribbon. But it shouldn't be surprising from a man who has actually claimed himself to be like unto Jupiter. So I do have plenty of preoccupations about Macron's haste to get the job done. I do hope the church will be, more than anything else, I hope that it's repaired in a way that is solid and durable. I hope the momentum of the interest for the church will really expand to people taking an interest in the church. And I also hope that the church will see that people are looking at it and use this opportunity of the reconstruction of a church that's been knocked down, beat up, and back on its feet again, to really use this church as a message of hope to people out in the world, that it really come back to being a beacon, more as an Instagram backdrop, but really as a place of hope where we seek salvation and where we seek solace.
Well, we'll pray through the intercession of Our Lady, the namesake of Notre Dame, that all those outcomes and all those good fruits can be yielded. Dr. Lev, thank you so much for your time today. It was a real treat.
Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts and help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.